Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We hope you had a great weekend at the racetrack. There was no activity today, and of course, glorious sunshine. We'll be here for the next 2 hours. The telephone number to call us with a question of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the 500-mile race is 239-1070. That is 239-1070. And give us a ring, and we'll be here and try and answer any question that you may have, providing that it is not of a controversial nature. some business to take care of while we're waiting for you to get dialed in here. The other night we were talking about Tassie Vattis. I think this was probably Thursday or Friday night, and I kind of stopped it at 1972, and that wasn't the end of the story. I think I wound up with Carl Williams and the City of Terre Haute special in what I neglected to mention when I was talking about Sam Posey in 1970 was that in 1971, or rather in 1970, Bentley Warren from Gloucester, Massachusetts, variously, and then also a little bit later, Kenny Bunkport, Maine, believe it or not. He qualified a Tassie Vattis car and got bumped. And then in 1971, Bentley Warren had two cars at his disposal and qualified for the race and finished 23rd. And then Bruce Walkup was in the other car. And then in 1972, we covered, and that was not the end of it. I cut off there, and in 1974, we had Johnny Parsons, who qualified quite late. In fact, I think he might have been... No, he wasn't the last successful qualifier, but he was one of the last in a year in which, due to energy crunch reasons, there were only two qualifying days, two Saturdays. And Parsons I think he was the first second generation. No, that's not true either. But he was the first son of a 500 winner to qualify, and plus his father was there and was in the qualifying shots. Then Johnny didn't finish that one. In 1975, Tassie Vattis had two cars, and it was Johnny Parsons and Mike Hiss, and neither one of those cars finished. Mike Hiss was 29th and Johnny Parsons was 19th. And in 1976, Johnny Parsons was 12th in the rain. Race that got stopped at just past halfway. They got 102 laps before the thing rained. And so he finished 12th in that one. And I think that was the last... I think that was the end of the Tassie Vattis years at the Speedway. Another one is that I made a statement on network and yesterday. I think we finally were able to correct ourselves a little bit later. I made the statement that Oriol Servia would be the first Spaniard to qualify for the race, and we were doing on the network show, and Johnny Parsons, in fact the very same Johnny Parsons we were just talking about, is the driver analyst this year, and he turned and had this quizzed look on his face and then looked up in the fact book, and he remembered that when he was in the 1996 race, he ran against Fermín Vélez, and he's absolutely correct. So Vélez actually was the first Spaniard. We'll be here for the next almost 2 hours and be happy to take your questions at 239-1070. That's 239-1070. And a lady called today and then asked me if I would tell a story that we haven't done on the air for quite some time. And that was about the wheel overhead situation. And in 1933, there was a newspaper headline in a newspaper in Colorado. I want to say Boulder, but I don't think that's right now. But anyway, it was a Colorado paper, and by the way, we've got another number that we can give out. We can also have. Can we use this number right now? Yes. All right. Just that. All right then. 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. and try that one to get in here with your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Anyway, this lady asked me to tell the story of Will Overhead. There was a newspaper came out at the day after the 1933 race, and the headline said, Will Overhead wins 500. And then you read on down the story, and it talked about that Will Overhead was a relative unknown, and that he had come up through the pack in the late stages to win the race. Well, what happened was, the fellow at this newspaper had been trying to track the race, and he was getting bulletins, and I think the last that he knew was Fred Frame had led, and so Louis Meyer and also Wilbur Shaw were in the mix, and what he did was he wanted to make sure that he would get the final results, and so he sent a message by Western Union to a reporter that they had there, or maybe it was a wire service guy. Anyway, his question was some message to say that, you know, let us know who wins the 500, let's know the results. And so the fellow on the other end messaged back a term that the term was that if you are it was Will Overhead 500 winner, meaning that he was going to make a lead story, and the fellow misunderstood the message and thought that Will Overhead was a guy's name. And so he thought, golly, what am I going to do? I don't know who this guy is, so I'll just have to write something. And he made him as a relative unknown. Anyway, that was the story. And we do have callers hanging on. The number, once again, to call is 1-800-603-6453. And let's go to Ray. You're first up. Good evening. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Donald.
How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
Okay.
Maybe I misheard you, but I thought you said that Johnny Parsons was the first son of an Indy 500 winner to qualify. Is that correct?
With his father standing there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I probably didn't clarify that, because I know he was in the photograph. In other words, let's say that Johnny Parsons Sr. was the first 500 winner to see his son qualify. How would that be? Because Vukovic was 68. And was he the first?
That's what I was thinking,
yeah.
But I wasn't sure.
Yes, I think that would be right. The first son of a former driver to qualify was Billy DeVore in 1937, and then there were several sons of drivers, but I think, and Norm Hauser qualified in 1949. Thane Hauser was the first former driver to see his son qualify, and I think Johnny Parsons was the first former winner to see his son qualify. Maybe that was I got mistaken.
Okay, well, I really enjoy the show. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping me honest, because if I said that, I think I was trying to clarify it thereafter, and probably didn't do a very good job of it. But we thank you very much for deep at the call, and let's go to Ron. You're next up. Good evening.
Afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
Fine, sir.
Good. I know you have limited time, so I just want to kind of keep this to his ownership days, but I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about Dick Simon. I didn't know when he quit bringing cars to the Speedway, and just a little information about him as a car owner.
All right. Well, actually, he was a car owner the first year that he came in 1970. It was entered as Racing International was his first run in 1970, and that was for himself. But in most years, he drove either for Rolla Volstead or Lita Cards, and then to jump around a little bit, the last year that he was involved was 1996. When he was handing his team over to Andy Evans, Scandia.
Okay.
And so I think they had like six cars in the race, and either all or most of them had been Dick Simon Racing.
Now, was Scott Brayton driving for Dick Simon when he passed away?
No, he would. No, Scott Brayton was driving for Menard.
Okay. All right. Hi, Don. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And in fact, I'll tell you what, Dick Simon There were some years when he was driving for Volstead, and it seemed like Dick Simon was the owner. I mean, he was always running the operation. I don't think I ever remember another a more energetic participant ever. And even when he was into his 50s, he would run back and forth, and not only was he tireless on the microphone and at the press conference tables, but also he was very constantly making sure that the sponsors were happy, and then also involved in a lot of his own mechanical work. He would run from place to place, and the one thing that I never understood was that he wanted to look sharp with the team uniforms, and he insisted on wearing a tie, and even when it was 95 degrees out there, he would wear this shirt, which was probably Nomex, I don't know. He wore a tie as well, and he just always looked hot. Anyway, we want to thank you all for your calls. We've got plenty of callers hanging on, and John, you'll be next. Let's just go ahead and take a break right now. All right, the number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. You're listening to Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Golly, I didn't realize before, that car's in stereo. It went through one ear and out the other. Anyway, we'll be here for the next hour and a half. Happy to take your calls of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The number to call for tonight is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. And let's go to the phones. And John, you're up. Good evening.
Good evening, Donald. How you doing?
Just fine, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you. I love the month of May, and one of my favorite things is getting to listen to you
every
thanks.
Night. Thank you.
And now it's for 2 hours, so it's even better.
Yeah.
So maybe we can get three next year. I don't
know. No, two's enough.
I'm in my early 40s, and my dad indoctrinated me to the Speedway when I think I was about 5. And one of the drivers that I saw was Joe Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he had car number one the first time I saw him, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I have followed all the Unsers and John Cock and Rutherford and been able to kind of follow them as they've gotten older. And I think Joe got hurt in Ontario, and he kind of fell off the map. And I was just kind of wondering what happened to him, and also if you could just kind of chronicle him a little bit. I know he started off on motorcycles, I think.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, he's still around. In fact, I've talked to him a couple of times just recently. He still lives in San Jose. And if you saw number one, then that was either 1972 or 1973.
Okay, Samsonite car, I think.
It was the Samsonite car both years. Yeah, okay. Different cars, but same sponsor, same number. And the reason is that he won the USAC National Championship in 71 and 72. His years at the Speedway and the Ontario accident was in the spring of 1974, and did end the career. I think in about 76 or 77, Foyt offered him a car at Ontario, and he did actually get into it to be fitted, but he realized that he wouldn't be able to do it. But it was very nice of Foyt to let him at least have the shot, but and I'll stress, they never even fired the engine up. He just had a fitting. So the 74 Ontario 500, which for a couple of years was held in the spring, and he had the accident, that would be the last time that he drove a race car. Accomplishments on four wheels, because as you mentioned, two wheels was... Actually, he would be in the motors... He would be... Well, he's in the Motorcycle Hall of Fame, but he was fairly legendary if he would never have driven a racing car. But he started racing, I think, in about 1950, and he came up through motorcycles, and I remember that when he first started to run stock cars and came to the Speedway as a rookie with Dan Gurney in 1965, I just assumed, well, you know, this fellow's been a motorcycle racer, and he got into stock cars, and he drove for Ray Nichols, and now he's looking for other worlds to conquer, and now he's into championship racing and coming to the Speedway. Well, as it turns out, he wanted to be a race driver from the time he was a kid, and he used to go to San Diego Stadium and watch Bill Vukovich and Walt Faulkner and all of those people racing midgets. And so he wanted to drive at the Speedway, and he said, but I couldn't afford it, and you kind of had to find your way there. And he said motorcycles was how I decided that I could probably get to the Speedway, which was pretty interesting. Anyway, he won. AMA used to crown a number of different champions through the years. They had no points championship. They had a series of races, and you would have the 5 mile champion and the TT champion and the 7 mile champion and all this kind of stuff on half miles and miles. And for some time, it had been suggested there should be an overall championship. And so in 1954 was the first year that AMA selected, I think, like 7 or 8 races, and they paid points fairly similar to what the World Championship drivers used to be. And so the first year that they did that, Joe Leonard was the overall national champion. And the runner-up was Paul Goldsmith, his very good friend. And the two of them sort of followed each other through their whole careers, and they remain good friends to this day. In fact, they've had shared a lot of things, even personally, with their personal lives. Anyway, as far as the Speedway was concerned, go ahead and say that after winning the championship in 54, he dropped to third in 55, but 56 and 57 he won it again. So with 3 championships, then he started looking to 4 wheels, and he drove West Coast Modifieds and Midgets a little bit, and then eventually he got on to the Nichols Engineering stock car team. And then in 1965, when Dan Gurney, this was the first year for All-American racers, Gurney had 3 cars, and Joe Leonard was one of the drivers he selected, himself and then also Roger McCluskey. Anyway, Joe was an early out at the Speedway, but he did win 150-mile race at Milwaukee, and I'm not even sure how many starts that would have been, but it couldn't have been any more than about 8 or 9 starts in championship cars, period. Anyway, in 66, he was ninth at the Speedway in an accident-marred event. In 67, and he was still driving for Gurney then, in 67, he drove for Foyt. They were teammates, and Foyt won the race, and Joe was third. In 68, he ended up in one of the STP wedge turbines, and that's a story and a half, and all kinds of trials and tribulations with drivers, but it ended up that Joe transferred from a team that Parnelli Jones owned with Val Miletic over to the wedge turbine, and then he won the pole, was expected to run away with the race, did not. Bobby Unser was fairly well dominant throughout, but in the late stages, Joe was in the lead with Bobby Unser second, and Bobby had lost all but top gear, so quick starts were not possible. And the green flag came out to restart the race after a late race caution at lap 191, or the completion of lap 191. And Joe pulled over to the side into the first turn amidst a huge crowd ovation for and against, because not everybody was a Turbin fan, but others were. And he was out of the race, having come within 9 laps of winning it. Anyway, in 1969, he drove a Smoky Unic and an Eagle with a turbocharged Ford, and actually got up to second at one point. Had some mechanical trouble. Attrition rate was high, so that was a year when he wanted to just keep running. He was quite a number of laps behind when Mario Andretti won the race, but Joe ended up sixth. And then in 70, he was teammate to Al Unser on Vels Parnelli Jones Ford Racing Team. And his deal that year was to run only 3 races. So he ran Indianapolis with Al Unser, but he dropped out, and it was one of the most excruciating reasons out when they found out later. The car just cut dead, and so he pulled off out on the course somewhere and couldn't figure out why the thing had stopped. And it turns out that he had hit the kill switch without realizing it, so there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. And then the next race was Milwaukee, which he won. And then they went to Ontario, and you forget what happened there, except he and Al Unser both dropped out. Al dropped out late. Anyway, in 71, then he did the full season with Al. And Al got off to a great start, won the 500, and Joe dropped out after they had a great battle. It was for about 20, 25 laps, it seems like. The two of them were battling for the lead, and they were back and forth and back and forth, and then Joe dropped out. Anyway, I said that Al won the 500, and shortly after that, it seemed that his season started to fall apart, and he eventually dropped down to fourth in the final standings, but Joe won the championship. And this is 71. Then 1972, Veles Parnelli-Jones' team was expanded to three cars with Mario in the super team, and even with Al and Mario as teammates, Joe won the championship again. Anyway, we need to wrap up here and take care of some business. So we thank you very much indeed for the call on Joe, and he is around. We do talk to him from time to time, and he loves to tell stories. And so I don't know if he's coming back this year or not. Anyway, hang on. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. Hang on, everybody. Back after this. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and we'll go straight back to the phones. And Chris, thanks for hanging on. Good evening.
Hello, Donald, and let me say a couple of things here real quick before I get to my question. First, I never thought I would learn auto racing history from a commercial, but I was wondering just the other day where the tradition of drinking the milk came from.
Oh.
I just heard it from the commercial with your voice on it, so that's really cool. And let me just say real quick, I was really impressed. I think it was so great to see the increase in the crowd size for qualifying Saturday, and I guess a lot of it was weather-related. But that was really great to see.
I believe it was weather related, and my personal opinion is that weather always has played a part in it. It's not the sole thing, but I think it's part of it. And honestly, we had a great day on Tuesday, and then it rained on Wednesday and Thursday and part of Friday. I believe that if it was hot and sunny every day, and there'd been a lot of running, And a lot of news out there about speeds being turned, I think you would have seen a lot more people on Saturday than we ended up having. But the weather got us again.
Yeah. Well, now as far as my question, now Jimmy Clark.
Yes.
I wonder if you could settle this discrepancy here. Now,
okay.
The latest issue of Motorsport Magazine, which, as you know, is a very reputable publication out of England, I believe. They said in the current issue, I believe it's still the current one, which has a tribute to Jimmy Clark, mm-hmm. that he won the 64 NASCAR race at Milwaukee. But I've looked at I've talked to other people that are NASCAR fanatics,
no.
and they say no way, he never won a NASCAR race, and they've even showed me out of different books where his history where it didn't indicate that.
All right, I see that magazine, but I haven't seen this issue, so I don't know how many people wrote pieces for that magazine. And knowing the new editor as I do, Nigel Roebuck, I can't believe that slipped through. But in 64, in 63, he won the Milwaukee 200 championship race with a Lotus in August. But in 64, the 500 was the only race that he ran because... Lotus ran the Milwaukee 200, and Parnelli-Jones drove the car that Clark would normally drive, and he won. And there weren't no... pardon the bad grabber here, but there weren't no NASCAR race at Milwaukee in 1964, so I haven't seen that issue yet, and I don't know where they got that from, but they got the wires crossed somewhere. Okay, Chris? Yeah, Chris.
Hello?
Yeah, you still there?
Oh, yeah. There's a little trouble on the line. I think that's exactly correct, because we would have heard more about it if he would have ever won a NASCAR race, and that's definitely true, and thanks for setting the record straight. And speaking of the history of Jimmy Clark, there's a book called Jim Clark Remembered that I have, and it's an excellent picture. And I hope that any of the yellow shirts are not listening. If they are, they can maybe go into the kitchen and fix themselves a sandwich, but there's a picture you probably know where Jimmy Clark is punching out a security guard at a racetrack, punching him right in the gut.
I think that's the Dutch Grand Prix.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's not a yellow shirt. That's he got into an altercation at the Dutch Grand Prix where a cop I think Clark didn't have the proper credentials,
yes.
But good Lord, he had a driver's uniform on, and he was Jim Clark, for heaven's sake. If you wondered about the guy's identity when the race started, it would be pretty obvious whether he was an imposter or not. So let's protect the yellow shirts on that one. About Clark in NASCAR, he did actually have one NASCAR start, and that was at Rockingham, North Carolina in 1966 in October. And he drove a Holman and Moody Ford, and I think his teammates were David Pearson and Bobby Allison, or no, maybe it was Fred Lorenzen. Anyway, they ran three cars, and Clark drove one, and he got up to 12th, and then dropped out, and they had Jochen Rindt was standing by as a relief driver, but he never got to drive, but so Clark did have the one start. So where they came up with Clark winning at Milwaukee in a NASCAR race in 64. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, Chris, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's move on. We've got Jay. Good evening. What can we do for you?
Hey, Donald, great show, and your program is one of the highlights of the month of May.
Thank you.
My question is, I remember watching reruns of old Indianapolis 500s, and if I can remember right, did a pace car crash on the parade, coming down pit road? And if so, what year and who was driving?
In 1971, that happened. And it was a very nice gentleman who I came to meet later, named Eldon Palmer, who had a car dealership, a Dodge dealership.
Okay, and it happened more down towards turn one, correct?
It was coming, yes. It was
okay.
Where the accident actually took place was just at about the point where the turn begins.
Okay. Has that ever happened before?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. We thank you very much indeed for the call. And next up will be Mark. Good afternoon.
Donald, thank you for taking my call.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Thought if you would elaborate a little bit on Dennis McCormick with McCormick Motorsports. And then the second, my question would be regarding Indy Lights, is are there any former champions of Indy Lights currently running in the big leagues today?
Well, I'll take the second part first, and I can't answer that because, honestly, that thing keeps changing names. I mean, it was Infinity Pro, and then it was just simply the Pro Series. And now it's called Firestone Indy Lights, and there was another series with different cars called Firestone Indy Lights. And honestly, I couldn't answer your question because it's just a jumble in my mind. But I'll take the first part, and that is that Dennis McCormick, I haven't seen around for a while. He was a mechanic, chief mechanic, who formed his own team, and the best finish that he had was ninth in 1997 with Robbie Gruff. Mike Gruff's brother finished ninth, the only year that he was here. And not only, I don't remember what the car name was because I don't think that car had any sponsorship on it. It seems to me that it was just white with a number, and I mean they had some lettering, but there was nothing major. He also had Marco Greco in there was a year when in 1994 Marco Greco did not qualify. So the only one I can think of in the race at the moment, because I'm a little hazy on the recent years, is Robbie Gruff finished ninth. And I haven't seen Dennis for quite a few years. So anyway, that's about the best I can do on that one. So we do need to take a break anyway. We've got plenty of callers hanging on, and so we appreciate your patience. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We will be back with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and the calls are stacked up, so let's go to Mike. Thanks for hanging on.
Good evening, Donald. Number one, I want to tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Number two, would you be willing to talk about Weber Shaw some?
Sure. What would you like to know?
Just
that's a pretty wide subject.
I realize that. If you could take a minute or two and just kind of reflect on what your prominent memories might be.
Okay. Well, I would say that Wilbur Shaw... Probably had the best record of any driver until Foyt came along. I think unquestionably for the up until into the 60s, his was the best record. He had the his starts ranged from 1927 to 1941, and he was fourth the first year that he ran. He was a local boy. Actually, he was born in Shelbyville, and spent his early part of his youth being shuttled back between Shelbyville and Greensburg. But he was in Indianapolis by the time he was quite young, and used to ride his bike out to the track. Was hanging out there. I don't think he went before the war, but he certainly by 1919 was hanging out at the track and wanted to be a driver, but he was just a kid. Anyway, 1927 was his first start, and he finished fourth, and his relief driver was none other than Louis Meyer, who was a year younger than him. The two future three-time winners, the first two drivers to win three times, actually shared a car to fourth in 1927. In 1928, a race that Louis Meyer won in a car that Wilbur Shaw was supposed to drive, and Wilbur Shaw ended up fourth as a relief driver for Ray Keach. In the 29 race, he wasn't in. 30, he was an early out. In 31, he did not qualify, but he drove as a relief driver for Fred Duesenberg, and co-drove two cars. And there's an anecdote compared with concerning one. He took over a car driven by Phil Pardee and crashed over the outer wall at the 60th lap, and then was uninjured, came back and drove another car to sixth place. There's a story there which I may come back to, but we do have plenty of callers hanging on, so I feel rather an obligation to them. Anyway, 1932, he led, and it looked like he might be a winner. He led for quite a distance in that one, broke down driving a car that was owned by Ralph Hepburn, who was injured. And then in 1933, he was second behind Louis Meyer. In 34, he qualified in the middle of the front row, dropped out early, and then took over for Lou Moore, who's probably better known as a car owner than a driver, but he was a very successful driver. And then Shaw drove that one to third. And then in 35, he finished second. In 36, in a car that he built himself with Myron Stevens, they led a good chunk of the race. And this was the car called he later called the pay car. It's the one with the shovel nose, the Gilmore Special, and the bodywork started to shake loose, and they made two fairly lengthy pit stops to fasten the bodywork, and he dropped out of the top 10 and was able to come back at the finish to get seventh. And then in 1937, he won the race for the first time. It had been 10 years since his first start, and back in those days, that was a lengthy career. 10 years now is not so long, but that's because of the fact that the turnover in drivers was greater because of the injury rate and so forth. Anyway, he won the race in 37, holding off Ralph Hepburn, his very good friend, by 2.16 seconds. And then in 1938, he was second. And then in 39, driving for Mike Boyle with a Maserati, he finished first in 39 and first in 40 to become the second three-time winner, joining Louis Meyer. But he was also the first person to win it twice in succession. And then in 1941 with the Maserati, it looked like he was going to do it again. He would have been the first four-time winner, and he also would have been not only the first person to win 3 years in a row. Nobody's done that yet. But he was leading at the three-quarter mark when a wheel collapsed and he hit the wall, and he did sustain some injuries, and there's a story to that one as well. But kind of hurry it along, and it's probably not fair to Wilbur Shaw to do this. After the war, he was the person most responsible for saving the speedway. All of the locals figured that the place was done for and was going to become a housing development, and he's the man that single-handedly tried to save the place, and eventually was led by a friend of his, Homer Cochran, who was a real estate broker, went over to Terre Haute, met Tony Holman, and made the deal to save the Speedway. And although he planned to drive after the war, Tony Holman, who was very shy and retiring, needed somebody as dynamic as Wilbur Shaw to sort of be the front man, and so Wilbur Shaw became the president and general manager, and he held that post until October 30th, 1954, which was the eve of his 53rd birthday, and he never made it home. He was flying back from Detroit, and the plane went down in a field up in Decatur, Indiana, somewhere near Huntington. But anyway, Wilbur Shaw's contributions, even if he'd never done anything beyond driving, he would have been one of the most important figures in the history of the track. And by getting with Tony Holman and saving the place and helping build it up after the war to bigger than it had ever been, Wilbur Shaw's contributions to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway are immeasurable. I mean, he's one of the two, three, four most important people ever. So anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and we got plenty of callers hanging on, so hang with us. We'll take a break, come back, and we'll try and get to all of you. We have a few minutes left on the first hour of the Talking Gasoline Alley, and our thanks to Dennis Reinbold and Robbie Buell, the principals of the Dry and Reinbold Racing Team, for being such gracious hosts throughout the whole month. And then also to everybody who was kind enough to call in, and we got plenty of them hanging. So let's go to Jim. Thanks for your patience. What would you like to hear about?
Hi, this is Tim from Xenia.
Yes, sir.
And I'm interested in a little bit of information of when they changed or what they've done about the start. For instance, was there ever a time like in the 50s and before when they would simply start the cars from the main straightaway and the first time around take the green flag?
Yes.
As opposed to having a parade lap and a pace lap, et cetera.
Yes, it wasn't until 1957 that they added a second lap. From 56 on back, the cars were lined up on the straightaway.
Right.
They fired up the engines, pace car pulled out with the field, came around, pace car pulls over, and first time by, they were starting the race. In 1957, they added what they called the parade lap, and then eventually they went to a third lap, and I'm hazy now as to when that was. I think it might have been like 1974 or somewhere in there, now that they had the turbocharged engines, and they decided that they needed a little more time to warm them up, so they did a third lap.
Was the change in the late 50s had anything to do with changes in the pit row?
Yeah.
And things like that?
Actually, yes. Thank you for bringing it up. They lined the cars up forever. They lined them up on the straightaway and then fired up and then pulled away. In 1957, with the they redesigned the pit area completely. The Japanese-style pagoda came down. Master control tower went up. And a separated pit lane was built, which may have been the first at any racetrack anywhere in the world. And the idea, it was for safety reasons, and the thinking being that they should, rather than pull over to the side of the track, which they've been doing forever, and the crew were vulnerable out there working on cars while the cars went roaring by, they made the separated pit lane. And then somebody had the idea to line the cars on race morning next to their pit, and that when the call came for gentlemen start your engines, that the pace car would come down the straightaway, and as it went by the entered to turn one, then the field would follow it out in single file and then form up into the rows of three. There was a problem in 57, which we won't go into now. And instead of changing it back, they went with the same program in 58, and there was even more of a problem. And so finally, mercifully, they went back to what they'd been doing forever that worked out okay, and that was in 1959. Then they lined the cars up on the track, 11 rows of three, and then the pace car fired up, and they left behind. But what they did was they left the second lap, so you had the parade lap and then the pace lap proper, and then at some point, and I want to say it was like around 74, they added the warm-up lap as well. So it's now a warm-up lap, parade lap, pace lap proper, and then start the race.
Great.
Okay.
Hey, thanks so much.
All right. We thank you very much, and I think we've got time for Greg. So, Greg, go ahead, and we'll at least try to give you a quick answer.
Hi, Donald.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Okay.
I want to thank you for what you do. My wife, Cindy, and I have been listening to you for probably 25 or 30 years.
Oh, well, thanks.
enjoy it more every year. But anyway, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about A.J. Foyt and George Bignotti and their time together, and the rumor that if they hadn't been so hard-headed, they probably would have stayed together a lot longer and won a lot more races.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about that.
And one other thing I do want to say, regardless of what they say about the little Italian guy, I think A.J. is by far the best there's ever been.
Well, Foyt and Bignotti, it was a pretty tempestuous relationship, and they actually split twice. They broke... if they'd stuck together, yeah, I mean, they probably could have won the 500 five or six times, because Bignotti won the 500 seven times, two with Foyt, two with Alonso, one with Graham Hill, one with John Cock, and one with Sneaver, and some of those could have been Foyt, but they split in 62. After they'd won the 500, and then they got back together again at the end of 62, but it's kind of funny the way that that happened. They didn't really plan it. They were just pulled back together and found themselves looking at each other, but then they won a bunch more races and split in 1965. Anyway, that's all the time that we have for this first part of the program. We will be back afterwards with the Network Indiana version of the Talk of Gasoline Alley, which is basically the same thing and the same number. The number to call will be 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll take some business here, and then we will be back. And, we can go for another minute here, because I forgot that we're on a different time. So, anyway, I can keep talking. I'm going to talk more about Bignotti. So remember what I just said, and then we'll I won't have to say it when we come around to a few more seconds. But Bignotti and Foyt, I've seen them occasionally talking to each other. I think this probably happened a couple of times, and as I've gone by, and probably a little cheeky of me, I've actually said to them, too bad you guys should have stayed together. You could have won 100 races, and they both grin. But that's okay. They had their success after they went their separate ways, but it just Bignotti and Foyt, that was a magic team. 1964, there were 13 USAC National Championship races, and Foyt won 10, all with Bignotti. So that was just a phenomenal season. Anyway, once again, we'll give you the number, because now we are winding up. It's 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll be back on the other side of the hour and do more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. And for those of you that came down to the track this weekend, especially on Sunday, yeah, we sat through the rain too. And today there was no track activity. And of course, the day is beautiful. And I think it will be beautiful tomorrow. And then practice starts again on Wednesday. And I hear showers are forecast. We can't win. Anyway, we will be here for the next about 55 minutes or so, going back in history, and happy to take your calls of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the 500-mile race. And we've got Steve from Kansas City hanging on. And Steve, good evening. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Donald. Thanks. Big fan of yours. It's a real honor to talk to you tonight, and I think you're a real cultural treasure and icon, so thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
What I'd like to know about is, you might comment on some of the most successful individual cars, maybe the one with the most top fives or the most 500 starts. I know, like the Maserati 3032, you know, with Shaw and Horn had a great run there. Is there any other ones that could kind of match that for a
I would say that the Maserati is unquestionably the most successful car ever, because of the fact that, as you mentioned, it won it in 39 and 40 with Shaw, and then led, you know, about the greater part of three quarters of the distance in 41, and then in 46, It was Horn was third, third again in 47, fourth in 48, and had problems in all three of those years, and could easily have, well, not could easily, but it could have won had there not been problems. But he, you know, dropped back and then had to race to catch up, but still saved those positions or salvaged those positions of third, third, and fourth. And then in 1949, the car is now 10 years old, and Lee Wallard led the race with it for a while before it broke down. And then finally, in 1950, it didn't make it, but Bill Vukovic took his rookie test. So it's a famous car. As far as other cars, you know, in more recent years, they didn't have the 10-year, but there have been four cars that won the race 2 years in a row. And the first was the Maserati. The next was the Blue Crown Special. There were two front drive cars, Maury Rose and Bill Holland. And Rose won with the same car in 47 and 48. And then the next one would be the Fuel Injection Special. That was Bill Vukovic, won it in 53 and 54. And then the fourth car that won 2 years in a row did it with different drivers, and that was the Bolland Special. It's the Bolland Exhaust Special. In 1957, it won with Sam Hanks, and in 58, as the Bolland AP Special with Jimmy Bryan, it won again. And all four of those cars are in the museum. Castro Neves won the race in 2001 and 2002, but those were different cars. So I would say the four back-to-back winners would be the logical contenders. And as far as there were cars that had longer tenures, there's one that you can trace all the way from 1927 up to 1948 in the race. It was entered in 49 but didn't make it. But there's a span of 21 years. But I would say that the Maserati would be the most successful, and then the Blue Crown and the Fuel Injection Special and the Bolland, you know, take your pick. Okay?
All right. Appreciate it. Thank
all right. We thank you very much indeed. And back to the phones. And Bill, go ahead, please.
Good evening. How are you? It's Donald.
I'm fine, and thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I've admired you for a long time. A caller called in 3 days ago, I believe, and asked the question, was there a riding mechanic or somebody related to the race related to Wyatt Earp?
Yes, I got a call on that.
Uh-huh. Yes, well, Dr. Earp was my doctor when I was a kid. I know quite a bit about him. What would you like to know?
Okay, was that Wyatt or was that Evanston?
I'm sorry, Wyatt Earp. He was, I believe, his grandson or his great-grandson. I'm not sure which.
Well,
but I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
No, I was interrupting you, and I didn't mean to do that. There was an Evanston Earp that was in the Old Timers Club.
Yes.
Is he the relative?
That's the relative of Wyatt Earp.
Okay.
And Evanston was my family doctor when I was a young boy.
Okay.
And by coincidence, he had a son, I believe his name was Johnny. I'm not sure. He's a couple of years, a long time ago, by the way. But his son was a couple of years younger than me. We were on a swimming team downtown, and Dr. Earp used to drive me home. He had a Crosley, if you can believe that.
Yes, I can.
Anyway, I just wanted, because I was amazed with your knowledge of the 500, which, of course, is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
That question did kind of throw you.
Yes, it did. So how was Evanston Earp related to Wyatt Earp?
I can't remember. I mean, I'm in my mid-60s now, and at the time I must have been 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe he was either his great-grandson or somewhere along that line. But he
okay.
was a direct descendant of him. I know that.
Well, I wish I had known that, you know, at the time. And a lot of those people I had, you know, available to me, for want of a better term. But as I've talked to a lot of people that do genealogy, you don't think to ask the people that could answer your questions until after they're gone, I'm afraid.
Okay, exactly. Now, I don't want to hog your show. I've got
it's
a
okay.
couple of quick questions if you have time for me. If you don't, that's, I understand.
No, pop them off.
First one, I have a shirt-tail relative that won the race in 1924, Joe Boyer. He drove relief. I know absolutely nothing about him.
Really?
going to ask these both, and then I'll just kind of listen to you because it went out of range of my car radio. The other one is, do you happen to know how many individual men have won the 500?
Okay, well, no, but I can give you an approximation. I wish you'd give me a call at the museum sometime because I'd like to talk to you. Joe Boyer, all of the family members were quite reclusive, so it's a little hard to find out anything about them. But Joe Boyer's father was also Joseph Boyer, and he was an industrialist, and he was the head of the Burroughs Adding Machine Company. And he was from St. Louis and eventually moved to Detroit. And everything that you read says that Joe Boyer, the driver, was born in Detroit. I've got a suspicion that he was born in St. Louis. But anyway, he was involved with the Chevrolet brothers very early on when they had the Frontenac specials. And I think that he assisted with the expenses, as it's been put tactfully. I think he also did the same thing with Duesenberg's.
He was very wealthy.
He was well-to-do, but he also he didn't need to be a race driver because it was dangerous back then, and I don't know what the family thought about it, but he actually went. He was one of Jimmy Murphy's teammates. They went to the French Grand Prix, and to everyone's amazement, Jimmy Murphy won the French Grand Prix on the Le Mans course before they had a 24-hour race. That was that didn't come along till 23. Anyway, Murphy won that with a Duesenberg, which the French did not expect. But Joe Boyer actually ran second for a while. But in 1924, he drove for the Duesenberg brothers, and they had the first American supercharged cars. In fact, I'll tell you what, it's probably we need to take a break here, and I can't do this one in a few seconds, so if you would just hang with us for a few moments, and everybody else that's kind enough to hang on, and we got them stacked up, I'll try and get to everybody. So if you hang with us, we'll just take care of this business, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana.
This is Sid Collins speaking to you from the control tower at the 1958 500. We threw the cue to Luke Walton, who had an unknown rookie driver standing by in the pits. Luke didn't know what this shy young man's initials stood for.
Let's go back to Luke Walton in the center pit. He has A.J. Foyt standing by.
Yes, Sid, here's the young man in his first race. He's from Houston, Texas, A.J. Foyt, Jr. And A.J., what's the A stand for?
Anthony.
What happened, Anthony?
Well, I guess I just hit a wall slick. Ever since the first time the wreck happened this morning, I spun it and kept going. But I don't know if something happened or it was me. It was getting awful slick, and it's just one of them deals in racing.
How you feel right now? You all right?
Well, I'm pretty disgusted on what happened. Other than that, I'm just fine.
How badly was the car damaged?
Well, not too bad, far as I could see. It's just the rear tires I blowed out going off the turn. But other than that, after the tires blowed out was when I locked the brakes up and started spinning.
After driving in the 500-mile race for the first time, what do you think of all this, anyway?
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I hope to be back next year.
Thank you very much, A.J. Foyt of Houston, Texas, A.J. Foyt, Jr., and now back to Sid in the tower.
And obviously, Foyt did come back, and often, and he hauled away the majority of Tony Holman's prize money. And our pit interviewer, Luke Walton, has learned what A.J. stands for, too. Sid Collins here in 1958 on another 30 Days in May.
You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and we neglected to advise you that that one was coming up. There's one of those every night. Sid Collins put those together in 1973, and so that was A.J. Foyt in 1958, and the term one of them deals in racing, we've heard quite a few times since. I didn't realize that it was up that early, so evidently that was something Foyt was saying even before he came to the Indianapolis Speedway. But anyway, it's great fun to hear those things. Anyway, we were talking to about Joe Boyer, and we little bit more time now. We've got plenty of callers. We'll try to get to everybody. The first time that Joe Boyer came to the track was in 1915 with Louis Chevrolet, who had a car called the Cornelian, which was a tiny little thing, probably one of the lightest cars that has ever been to the Speedway. I don't remember what the weight was, but it was only like about 1,000 pounds. I mean, it wouldn't even be eligible now. But anyway, Louis Chevrolet was not a diminutive person, and so it was determined that, and the rules were different in those days, that they should try somebody else to try and qualify the car. And Joe Boyer actually qualified the car because he was rather diminutive, except a lot more so than Louis Chevrolet. And he qualified the car, and maybe he was standing by as a relief driver, but he did not participate in the race. And then in 1916, a similar thing happened. They had a car that they needed to get qualified, and Gaston Chevrolet, the third brother, who was quite young at that time, in 1916, golly, he would only have been about 21, and at the last minute they decided to give Joe Boyer a chance, and he qualified that one as well. And then Louis Chevrolet ended up driving the car in the race, and Joe Boyer relieved him. And then Joe was with the Frontenac, with the Chevrolets and the Frontenac Specials in 1919 and 1920. In 20, he led quite a chunk of the race, and but they didn't finish. And then in 21, then he went to Duesenberg's, as I mentioned, and his car dropped out of the 500, although he was on the front row. He was on the front row, by the way. He was the second fastest qualifier in 20, next to Ralph De Palma, with driving a Frontenac. De Palma was in a Ballot. And then 21, he was on the outside of the front row with a Duesenberg. He didn't finish, but he co-drove for Frenchman Albert Guillot to finish sixth, with Eddie Miller also co-driving, but this is getting a little complicated. In 1922, for whatever reason, he didn't drive, but he was the assistant starter, and he was very much the sportsman, and he was involved in powerboat racing, and he was a very good friend with Eddie Edinburn, who was the longtime chief steward, who actually had been in Indianapolis as a young man, and then moved to Detroit. And during the years that he was the chief steward for the race, and because of his connections in Detroit with the various country clubs and so on and so forth, he and Boyer became very good friends. In 1923, there was Packard decided to do a team of three cars, which were not successful, but it was quite a team. It was Ralph De Palma was the team leader, and he hired Dario Resta, who had been runner-up to him in 1915, and then won the 300-mile race that was held before the war in 1916. And then Joe Boyer, who had not won the 500, got the third car. He would win the next year, and eventually we'll get to that. But there was a tie-in with Packard, and not the only reason that Boyer was on the Packard team, but there was an interesting tie-in that the head of Packard was Alvin McCauley, who, as a younger man, had worked for the Burroughs Adding Machine Company as an assistant to Joe Boyer Sr. So it's another one of those things that people have heard me talk about. It's fascinating to know who knew who when, and you never know who knew who when. Anyway, the Packards did not finish, and that didn't work out very well, but in 1924... it was back to Duesenberg's, and Mercedes had been at the track in 23 with gear-driven superchargers, the first ever, and then the centrifugal or centrifugal superchargers were on three of the four Duesenbergs in 24. Joe Boyer had won. He qualified fourth. He led the first lap. He was in the pits on the second lap and struggled with the car for quite a while, and then it was decided to bring one of the other cars in with L.L. Corum. Laura Corum came in and handed over to Joe Boyer, who took off a reasonable distance behind the leaders and was able to catch them and then win the race. So co-winners were declared in 1924 because one started and the other finished. But tragedy came in September at Altoona, Pennsylvania, a board track, and there Joe Boyer had a very serious accident and did not survive. He passed away the following day from the injuries. And as I said earlier, there are some family members around, but they are very reclusive, and it's a little hard to find out anything about their personal lives because they they've kept their tracks fairly well guarded. But anyway, if the gentleman would like to give me a call at the museum sometime fairly soon, although really after the race would be better, but at any time I would be very happy to hear from him. And let's go to, I believe Mike is up next. Mike, are you
Donald,
there?
Yeah, I'm Donald Mike from Vernon Hills calling again. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling in.
Good. Can we talk about driver Bill Cheeseburg, please?
Sure. Bill Cheeseburg was, this will be a two-parter, I can guarantee you that. Bill Cheeseburg was from Tucson, Arizona, and his years at the track were from 1956 until 1968 rather was the last time that he was in a car. He was the 10th place finisher in 1958 with a Novi, but he really was a great guy. I came to know him quite well, and we do need to take a break, so this obviously is going to be a two-parter, but I'll just take a few moments to thank once again Robbie Buell and Dennis Reinbold for being such gracious hosts during the month of May. And give you the number once again is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll be back in a few minutes with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We're back with the last half hour of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana, and thanks everybody for hanging on. I'm sorry we do the kind of long-winded answers here, but right before the break, the question was about Bill Cheeseburg, and I said that his tenure with the track was 56 through 68. He wasn't in the race in either of those years, and nor some of the ones in between, but 57 was the first start. He drove the Las Vegas Club Special for Fred Gerhard and qualified and got bumped, and then qualified one of my favorite car names, the Schildermeyer Seal Line Special, which finished 26th, didn't finish. And then in 58, he was in several cars in practice, but he got into the second Novi, the Novi Automotive Air Conditioner Special, and this is the one that Juan Manuel Fangio had taken a few practice laps in, a great five-time world champion. And he was a final qualifier, started 33rd, was involved in the first lap accident, kept on going, and ended up 10th. And in most cases, spectacular starts were his forte. In 1959, after being in several cars, he qualified the Greenwich Casale Special. And some of you may remember that's the one that had the engine hanging out the side, which was an experiment to put more weight on the left-hand side. And Jimmy Davies had not been able to qualify that one, so Cheeseburg took it over, qualified for the outside of the 10th row, and he got up to 6th in about 10 laps, and then had some problems and then dropped out. And then 60, he wasn't even in the lineup. And then 61, after being in several cars, he drove a second Dean Van Line Special. Actually, there were three cars that year. Eddie Sachs was on the pole. Cheeseburg started outside of the third row and charged typically at the start. And Jim Herdebees from the outside of the front row took the early lead, with Sachs running second. And at one point, for a few laps, Cheeseburg actually passed Sachs to run second. So that was by far the best run that he ever had. But he faded, and I think he was right at the tail end of the first 10 when there was an accident. He didn't start it, but he got caught up in it, and that's one where Jack Turner flipped on the main straightaway, and several cars were involved. There were no injuries, but Bill Cheeseburg was taken out of that one. And then in 62, he was in one of the Novis but didn't get qualified, and also drove for Mickey Thompson. 63, he wasn't in the lineup. And then 64, another one of my favorite car names, the Arizona Apache Airlines Special, which was formerly the Metal Cow Special that Jimmy Bryan had driven, except it was now red. And Cheeseburg started 33rd again. He started 33rd three times, and he dropped out I think 142 laps or something like that, and was 16th in 64. And then in 65, drove a rear-engine car, and it was... I'm mentioning another radio station here. It was the WIFE Good Guy Special. And he started at 33rd and passed a bunch of cars and had a problem and was one of the first ones out. He finished 32nd. So that was his last start. There was a car in 1966 that had air-cooled Porsches in front and behind the drivers, and it was effectively a four-wheel drive car, but it was twin-engine. Can't do anything like that now. And he practiced that one, but never went to the qualifying line. But Cheeseburg was a great guy, very much of a gentle giant. I mean, it was kind of disarming to meet him because he was huge. He had massive arms, and yet he was just a very sweet-natured person. And he was one of those guys that just kept coming back and coming back. And he was on the Champion Highway Safety Program for a while, by the way. He was a lecturer for high school kids on safe driving tips. And after 68 was his last year at the track, he qualified and got bumped. And then he went back to Arizona, and he ran stock cars for a while. And there was a time he ran up in Michigan, and I had just missed him. I'd gone out to lunch. I was working at USAC, something I wouldn't normally do. And I came in, and they said, oh, Bill Cheeseburg was here. And I hadn't seen him for years, and I missed him then. And then he had a heart attack and passed away not too long after that. But anyway, we thank the caller very much indeed for asking about Bill Cheeseburg. It was somebody that we knew, got to know, and really liked very much. Let's go back to the phones. And Neil, apparently you've been hanging on for quite some time. So, we appreciate your persistence, and maybe we can answer your question.
Hi, Donald. I don't know if you remember me. I met you at the museum around November, and I had memorized all the winners, and you gave me allowing me to recite them to you.
Yeah, I think I asked you for 29 and 55, I think, and then you did the whole thing.
Yes. I ask you a question. In all my research, I had never been able to figure out what the practice and qualifying schedule was in the teens, 20s, and 30s, and you kind of told me what that was, and you told me that you found a lot of your information, I believe, off microfilm at the state library.
Yes, that's correct.
And I was wondering if you could share that information with the listeners about what the practice and qualifying schedule was in the teens, 20s, and 30s. I'm not sure what year it switched over to the dual weekend format.
Well, I can tell you that. I think this is probably going to be a two-parter. I'll just say that the first time they went to the two-weekend format, Saturday, Sunday, and then the following Saturday and Sunday was 1952. And prior to that, it's probably best if I just go back to the beginning and bring us up to date. So, well, we do need to take a break here, but hang on, and we'll come back and give you the answer on that. I'm not going to look it up. We just need to take care of some business. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and we appreciate everybody's patience. And Neil was asking about the history of qualifications and practice, and it began in 1911 with the track opening on May the 1st, with the race on May the 30th. Nothing said that you had to be here all the time. It was just that on May the 1st, the track became available for anybody who wished to come out and become familiar with it. They had a qualification of sorts, which is very different to what it is now. You had to be able to average 75 miles an hour from a flying start for a quarter of a mile down the main straightaway. So somewhere, I think, coming through turn four or something, they let you get up ahead of steam, and you'd come through turn four, and then I suppose somebody would drop a flag as the car went by them. The stopwatch was on, and if you could get to the other end of the trap in 12 seconds, then you had averaged 75 miles an hour for the quarter mile on the straightaway, and then you were included in the field. If you couldn't do it, you got two more tries. If you couldn't do it after three, then you were excluded, and then the cars were lined up according to the order of entry. But those qualifying days were on May the 27th and 28th. So the track was open for almost a full month before you got to qualifying. Well, the method of qualifying changed. The next year they went to one lap, that you had to be able to average 75 miles an hour, and then by 1920 they went to the four lap, up to three attempts, one checkered flag, up to two wave-offs in complete attempts. So they started in 1920. But through those years, the qualification were fairly close to the race, with the track always opening on May the 1st. By 1925, they'd moved it to a little earlier, and I believe in 25, the first qualifying day was now May the 22nd. And for the next few years, it sort of moved a little bit earlier and a little bit earlier. And then in 1932 is when it was fairly well established to the way that it is now, where the track, well, at that time, because we're not doing this anymore, the track still opening May the 1st, and then the first qualifying weekend would be May the 15th, May 15th and 16th, or 16th and 17th, or however it fell. And then thereafter, they would determine when to have additional qualifying depending on how many cars needed to do it yet. And they would add days, and several times it would be in the on a weekday. But by 32, as I say, it was established that the first qualifying day would be about halfway through the month. So the additional qualifying days for the week would go, because, you know, everybody would wait till the last minute and they'd have to add a day. The extreme example of that is 1947, where for a variety of reasons they actually qualified on eight different days. In 1951, it was over three weekends, three consecutive Saturdays and Sundays, and then in 1952 was the first time that they cut it to the two consecutive weekends only. And it remained that way pretty much to date, with the exceptions that in 1974, due to the first of two rounds of the energy crunch situation, they actually lopped the first week of practice off. And so now the track opens, you know, it became a shorter month. And then for a while, and I'm hazy on the years now, I think it was like 98 and 99 or 99 and 2000, they decided to see if they could do it in one weekend. Oh, back on that energy crunch thing, not only did they lop a week off, but they just qualified on two consecutive Saturdays, with Sundays being practice days. But for a couple of years, and I think 98 and 99, 2000, somewhere in there, they tried to do the whole thing on one weekend, just a Saturday and Sunday period. And then they went to 3 days where it was Saturday and Sunday, and then the following Sunday, and then they tried that for a couple of times, and now they're back to the 4 days, except that it's just a little bit different from the way that it was. But nothing ever stays the same. Only us. We're still on 1070. They changed everything else. We're still here. And so I think, you know, hopefully that's a suitable answer, and we kind of did a quick one on that. Jay, let's at least start with you. We've got a couple of minutes before we need to take a break, so thank you for calling in again. And what would you like to hear about tonight?
Well, Donald, in the years before the checkered flag ended the entire race,
yep.
I wonder if there were any dramatic finishes that happened, you know, after the winner had already taken the checker.
Oh, sure. And what you're referring to is the fact that up until, well, as late as 1963, they let the race go for as long as 17 minutes, which was the case in 63, and then they changed the rules in 64. They would let it go for 5 minutes only, and then by 75, the rule was that they would do it as they do it now, with the winner crossing the line. But there was the close finish in 37 for first, and I don't think this is what you were after, where Wilbur Shaw was able to hold off Ralph Hepburn at the finish, and Hepburn finished second, 2.16 seconds behind. As far as races for positions, I think in 1928, the difference between the car driven by Fred Comer and Cliff Woodbury and the Stutz Black Hawk of Tony Gallotta and Dutch Bowman, I think that was sort of like less than a second. And there may be some other examples, but I'm not going to give you a very good answer. I mean, you mean that the winner's in victory lane, the cars are still going by, and then here comes a great battle for seventh place, and they're side by side and side by side, and so-and-so wins by a nose. I, you know what? You got my curiosity. I'm going to probably go home and check the times, but I'm almost sure that, as I said, in 28, I think there was like less than a second between 9th and 10th. But great question, and we appreciate your continued support. This is Jay from St. Paul, and I'll try to look that up tonight, and then I'll give an answer tomorrow night on the program, and thanks for calling every time, Jay.
Okay.
Appreciate it. All right, Dave from Marion, let's at least get you to tell us who you'd like to hear about, and then we'll have to take a break. How are you doing this evening? Hi, Dave from Marion. Are you there?
Am I on?
You are on, finally.
Oh dear!
What do you want to hear about? Have you made up your mind yet? Chris, who answers the phone, says that when he asks you what you'd like to ask about, you say, "I don't know, but I'll think of something." So, what do you got?
Okay, Cliff Bergier. I know it's a long run.
That's all right. We got time.
16 races. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct.
Later,
yeah.
Tied by Chet Miller, and yep. Then a guy named Foyt came along.
That came along a lot later, yeah. You want to hear about Cliff Bergier?
Yes, please.
All right. We do have to take a break, and I don't have your answer yet on Bobby Grimm and the XK140, but we'll come back and we'll talk about Cliff Bergier and his very colorful career when we come back after this. You are listening to The Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We have just a few minutes left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and thank you to everybody who called tonight. I didn't count the calls, but we got through quite a few in spite of my long-winded answers, and we have a very loyal listener, Dave from Marion's, on the phone asking about Cliff Bergier. So I'm in the time left, because he did have 16 starts, and rather than do all the finishes, I'm going to sort of kind of pack it in a little bit and tell a couple of anecdotes about him. Cliff Bergier was a first-generation American. His parents were French. His father was a banker in New York, and at some point they moved to California. Cliff Bergier was very, very military and distinguished in appearance. He was tall, had a mustache. And as unlikely as it may seem, if you would see photographs of him or have known him in later years, he was a Hollywood stuntman for years, and probably appeared in, it was like 200 or 300 films, I think, that he had appeared in, and he did stunts where he would climb from a plane into a car. And he crashed a lot of cars, and he doubled for all kinds of actors and actresses. He actually doubled for Katharine Hepburn once. But one of his roles was he was in the Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, and his role was Chief Chariot Wrecker. Anyway, his tenure in the 500 was 1927 was his first start, and he finished ninth with a Miller that was co-driven by Wesley Crawford. In 1929, he was ninth again. He was in the 28 race, but I'm hurrying through the thing here. In 28, with Pete Criss co-driving, he finished ninth. In 31, he was ninth again with the Rio Alco Real, which was a production-based car. And then in 32, he drove for the Studebaker team. Studebaker from South Bend did a five-car effort with racing chassis and bodies, but with President straight-eight engines in. And they did that 2 years. And they were reasonably successful, but by far the best finish was Bergier, finishing third in 1932. In 34, his car finished seventh, the Floating Power Special, which was co-driven by Billy Wynn and Tony Galata. In 37, he was fifth with the Midwest Red Lion Special with George Barringer co-driving. In 38, he dropped out, and I'm jumping over these, but 38 I like to mention because it's one of my favorite car names, Crafts Real Rye Special, which ended up 20th, but he co-drove for Herb Ardinger and finished sixth. In 39, he finished third for Lou Welsh in one of the Ford V8 Miller cars, which now had an Offie. And then in 40 and 41, the Knockout Hose Clamp Special. And in 41, he was trying to go the distance without a stop, which he did. He actually went the 500 miles without a pit stop, but it probably was his undoing. He actually led late with Maury Rose, as we've talked about before, took over the car of Floyd Davis and came from behind and came up to take the lead, actually passing Cliff Bergier. So Lou Moore cars were first and second for a few laps, but Cliff started to fall back because he was becoming ill from the fumes, but he never did give up and managed to finish fifth. And then in 46, he was on the pole but didn't finish. And then 47, he drove the Novi, started in the middle of the front row, dropped out with the one car, but a second Novi had been built. And I'm galloping here. He took over Herb Ardinger's car and finished fourth, which was one of the few times that a Novi actually finished. That was his last start. He was still around as late as 1950, but then he retired. And he did appear in the film To Please a Lady, which you, if you're familiar with the very end of the film, when the Clark Gable character has an accident and the Barbara Stanwyck character goes running to the infield hospital and a security guard stops her and says, "Lady, lady, you can't go in there." Well, that's Cliff Brazier, because he knew Clarence Brown, who had directed the film from the MGM days years earlier. Anyway, more to tell about Cliff Brazier, but we've kind of run ourselves out of time. We're worn out. And we want to thank Chris May for being the on-site producer. Scott Johnson is taking tonight and tomorrow off. Well-deserved. But we will be back with you tomorrow at 6 o'clock with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and then later at 7 o'clock on Network Indiana. That's about all the time that we have for. Thank you for calling, everybody. We will talk to you tomorrow night. Good night.